Okay, so I have a friend who is beautiful, supermodel pretty. She doesn't brag about it, flaunt it or anything, but it is what it is. And one night, we go to the dance club in San Francisco, crowded, getting our groove on. All eyes are on her. Men, women, it does not matter. I'm only cool by proximity, grooving. And then she smiles funny, like she senses disturbance in the force. And I ask, what's wrong? She laughs, nothing's wrong. But someone very beautiful just walked in. And I look behind her, a woman descends down the stairs, olive skin, dark hair, legs to infinity. She's a stunner. How'd you know that? I can sense it. You can sense beauty? Yeah, before you see it. Yes. Well, how does that work? And she looks at me. Seriously now, with that flawless face, and it feels like sadness when she says that beauty is a cage and you can feel every single person locked inside. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, Cross to Bear. Amazing stories from real people carrying their own specific burden. My name is Glenn Washington. Please note, I have a face made for radio because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off today's Cross to Bear episode in a land far, far away. Our story begins one night in the middle of a rainstorm, a poor Iranian neighborhood where a mother's whispers reveal the secret behind a young boy's identity. Snap Judgment.
One night, there was a horrific storm happening. We were living in this dingy, tiny room in the basement of this ramshackle house in the slums of Iran. We were sleeping on the ground. We didn't have any furniture or beds or anything. And it was wet and cold and shaking. And suddenly my mother came and started talking to us. She decided at that moment to tell us a little bit about us. And I sat there very curious and listening to her. And she said, I want you to know that we are from a very ancient historical nation called Children of Israel. I am one of those, and whoever a child is born from a Jewish mother, it will be a Jew as well. So that night she revealed this fact about our background, our bloodline, and I became a Jew. I found that I'm Jewish. And the same time my mother mentioned, she got this very, very serious expression on her face, and she said, there's something very important you need to remember. You should never say anything about this to other people. You know, in Iran, if a person is Muslim, formally, officially is a Muslim, and then later on changes or her religion to anything other than Islam, that person would be apostate and should be executed. So that was the danger, because my father was a Muslim man. And so according to Islam, if your father is Muslim, you are Muslim. And according to Judaism, interestingly, if your mother is a Jew, you are Jewish. So it was a lethal secret. I'm faking prayers, I'm faking Ramadan. Iran used to have the largest Jewish community in the Middle East after Israel. But 80% of them have left Iran since 1979 because it's unsafe. So they live in ghettos, in special suburbs, and they have their synagogues as well. So they can practice their religion. But we couldn't because we had a Muslim father. We just cherished this faith in our heart. And my synagogue was in our basement. One day I scratched a Star of David on the wall, on the brick wall, and that was my secret garden. I was going to that star and talk to him, because anytime I was heartbroken or angry or furious or disappointed, I was frustrated, I would come to it and talk to the star. And yeah. Things started to change dramatically in Iran since 1978. People were coming out in the streets, religious leaders and mullahs. It was my birthday. We were listening to radio on BBC One. We had this old ancient radio in the house. And there was a major demonstrations happening, tanks rolling around in the streets and soldiers everywhere shooting people and arresting people. Suddenly, there was a banging on the door. We all got startled and panicked. And then my father decided to go and check it. So he said, stay here. He went to the door, but we followed him as usual. I found that my father talking to this frightened man, young man, maybe 18, 19-year-old, in fear with him. And he was begging my father to allow him to hide in our house. And he was saying, they're going to shoot me if they find me. I've been in demonstrations. Please let me come in. And my father was refusing. He said, no way. At the end, I held my father's arm, and his sleeve actually, and I said, Dad, maybe let him go to the bus. Anytime Dad was home, which was like once every fortnight, he would park his 14-meter-long bus in front of our house. So Dad said, okay, go get the key. And there was this big key for the bus door. I grabbed the key and ran to the bus and said to the man, Yalla, come in. Quick, and he jumped in. We lie down, we close the door. We are in this very, very tiny space, the lying down next to each other, squashed in. We were breathing on each other's face in absolute silence, just waiting for the shooting and the military to go away so it's safe again. We come out, and then I realized, why am I here? Like, I asked myself, well, I just realized I'm trapped next to him inside. There were soldiers going around and shootings. After a couple of hours, eventually, you know, everybody felt like everything is over. So we opened the door and we came out. He said to me, you are a very brave boy. You saved my life. He was very, very grateful for that. What's your name? And I said, oh, Kusha. And then he said, I'm Ali. My name is Ali Mazahiri. The surname is Mazahiri, Ali Mazahiri. I never forgot that name. Very, very crucial moment. That played a major role in my life later on. When I grew up, I became a doctor. I was working in the hospital, and also I had my private surgery. One day it was Friday. Friday was the weekend in Iran because of Islamic law again. Anyway, I was at home. There was a knock on the door. When I went to the door, there was this two women covered with black chador, black hijab, at the door and very quiet. And the older one started talking to me. And she was desperate and begging for help. I took them inside, and soon I realized that the younger one had actually seen a boy, had a relationship with a boy. And they were not married, so that was a big, big trouble for her. But the biggest one was that she found herself pregnant now. If our father find that, he will kill her. Or if, you know, in Iran, virginity is a matter of life and death for a girl. She ended up in hospital because she tried to kill herself. She took 20 something Valium tablets. After 2 days in coma, she woke up one day, and the person who was on side of her bed was my friend, and he found that what had happened, so he sent her to me. That's how this new life started for me. I maybe performed around 250, 300 cases of terminations and 150 cases of repairing virginity. And the punishment for it in Iran is horrible. But I kept doing it and living in severe anxiety. When a patient approached me, I was always skeptical and suspicious and very cautious to make sure the patient is not like an informant or someone to try to catch me. You can't put a sign on your door saying, you know, termination of pregnancy happened. You get your hymen repaired here in this makeshift operation room that I managed to create in my house. And sometimes I would say, I'm not going to do it anymore, because at the time I had my first daughter, a four-year-old Nisha, which I loved and to death, and I still do. And I was just worried about her. What's going to happen to her if I'm executed or if I end up in jail? But then again, someone would come to the door crying and desperate, and I couldn't say no. I did it again. Everything I did in Iran is somehow a manifestation of my Judaism. If I was Muslim in Iran, probably, most probably, I would have behaved in a different way. A lot of doctors don't do it because of their religious faiths, religious beliefs. I was coming home one day in the early afternoon, I think. Yeah, I was in this narrow lane, and suddenly I felt this car coming behind me very slowly. I kept walking, didn't look back, and I realized the car stopped and door opened and a couple of people got out. I just glanced from the corner of my eye. I glanced at the car. It was a black car. My blood froze in my veins and my heart stopped beating. I thought, whoa, the black car, could this be the one for me? And then it was. And a few seconds later, two men came to me, on each one on each side of me. I just managed to stutter a few words, saying, what is it about? I haven't done anything. It's a pathetic thing that you say to save your life. I was thinking of Nisha, my daughter, a four-year-old girl at the time, my main concern. I knew they would be looking for me. There was maybe a list of 12 things easily that could be the reason for my arrest. They blindfolded me, took me to a room. So this was my, if you like, interrogation room. I always admired the revolutionaries, and the day I was arrested, and I was thinking, no, I'm not going to say anything, I'm going to stay strong, and this is it, this is my time to be a hero. Whatever they do to me, I'm not going to betray anyone, because women who got in trouble could get stoned to death, or there was a lot of people and a lot of things that I knew about people, and I had to protect them. Then very soon I realized this is far from reality. It's impossible. The level of pain and that they apply to you, it's unimaginable. It's not, I cannot describe it. They make you confess to things that you haven't done, so you stop the pain. You really beg for dying. I really wanted to die, but to stop the torture, just end my life. But they know very well how to deliver the pain and the torture and damage you without inviting death. Like that's what they learn. After I was tortured, after I was whipped and flogged and all that, in absolute silence was broken. This man came, this very, very clever man, very intelligent interrogator came and said to me, took me to another room with him. It was just me and him. He basically explained to me everything. He said, we know about terminations, about the books. We got this Torah book and some Jewish items from your house. We know you are not Muslim. We know you are against Islamic government. We must hang you according to Islamic rules. This is exactly his words. The holy government has been very kind and not having you executed so far. And now we are going to give you a chance. If you cooperate with us, do what we want you to do, we can let you go. And that was the best news in the world. I couldn't believe. I was very grateful. I was going to say, yeah, I will do anything. Just let me go and see my daughter again. And he said, we want you to be our eyes and ears. So indicated to me that they wanted me to work as an informant. For what? For what group of people? For what subject? What was the aim? Nothing was explained to me. A couple of days later, I was released in out of town somewhere, and I walked home, and I remember I pressed the ring, the doorbell, with my head, because my arms and back was so sore I could hardly raise my arm. And I was back home, but a different person. And a new life started. My life was over. Six months later, I realized that I am actually spying on fellow Jews in Iran, the people who are cherished and loved and protected. I was spying against them, getting information from them, passing it on to Big Brother. So immediately I thought, I'm not going to do this. It's horrible. I knew if I don't, I would be executed. So I thought I would be a lousy spy. I would, you know, not be very effective and basically spoil the job. My handler, Haji, contacted me. They had given me a special mobile phone that I realized later on they were locating me, you know, some with a kind of GPS system. He told me that we want you to go to and meet this old retired photographer, and I want you to become friend with him and get as much information that you can. He was a very close friend with Jews. He's got precious information about them. And I went, found this man's address and rang the bell, and this lovely elderly man with gray hair came out, and he invited me inside. I went to his house and I said to him, I'm writing a book about history of Iranian Jews. He gave me something around 20 photographs of different Jews living in Mashhad and that part of Iran, from the bar mitzvahs, the weddings, synagogue. And he had a lot of information and photos about Jews. And he said, you can have them and for 1 week and bring them back to me. And next day, my handler, Haji, rang me. I went to see him and I just cut out some parts of information, and at the end, I gave him just four or five photos and I said, this is what I've got, just one quarter of what I had. A few days later, he wanted to see me again. So I got in the car, maybe 1 hour driving. I started getting really, really anxious about this. I knew something is not right. So we went to an industrial part of Mashhad. Three guys started questioning me and bashing me and put me on a chair. And this elderly man came who, you know, I knew it was the same man. He was the photographer. At the end, he put his cigarette on my chest, two spots. Don't betray us. The whole thing was a test, and they had sent me to this man to see how trustworthy I am. That moment, I realized I can't do anything and I can't play with these people. And over the next few months, a lot of things happened that I realized they somehow watching me anywhere I go. They know everything about me. This plot that Iran was doing. The plan was collecting information and fabricating cases against a few Jews in Iran, and then later on go there and arrest them and announce to the world that these people, these Jews, Iranian Jews, are Israeli spies. Actually, they are doing espionage for Israel, and put them on death row to put pressure on Israeli government to release some Hezbollah terrorists. One of the very nice people that I was spying on, unfortunately, was this jeweler. one specific night, he shut down the shop, he closed the door, and it was just me and him. And he started talking about things that he believed and things that he's done to protect other Jews. Everything he was telling me, I was thinking, oh my God, these things he's saying, he can get into big trouble, and he's got family, and such a... He talks from my heart. He's, what he says is what I believe. But at the same time, I've got this tape recorder inside me on my breast pocket, in my jacket, that's recording him. There was no way I could even indicate to him, or, you know, eye gesture to him or anything to stop talking. I could imagine him getting tortured. While he was talking, I was sitting there imagining him, like, what happened to me will be happening to this man. I was seeing him devastated and covered with blood. I was just hoping that he stopped talking or he says something else. But he kept talking about it, and he was actually happy to find a safe outlet to take this off his chest and tell me.
13 Iranian Jews are awaiting trial in southern Iran on charges of spying for the U.S. and for Israel.
Rabbi Michael Melchior says the charges against all of the Jews are completely baseless.
This is a vicious lie. Everybody who has investigated and knows what goes on knows that this is a vicious
Under
lie.
Under Iranian law, the crime of espionage carries penalties ranging from 6 months in prison to death.
I saw that in newspaper for the first time. And then I heard it on the radio, the mullah talking about 13 Jews being arrested. I was absolutely panicked, devastated. Oh my God, who are they? This must be the people I spied on. These are the people, like, for example, that man, the jeweler. First they said, we are going to execute all of them. So they lived in this horrible fear of execution for a while, and they were interrogated, and their houses, their families were devastated. And at the end, one by one, under international pressure, they were released. But I think because I've been there, I know the damage and the scar in your body and in your mind is horrible, and it's forever. One night, it dawned on me that I don't think they will let me walk away at the end of whatever plan they have. I think they will definitely, as they call it, eliminate me. Or maybe I can escape. And the word escape came out for the first time. And then immediately I thought, that's impossible. I don't have passport. I'm not allowed to leave the country. I'm not allowed to leave town anywhere. There was just one hope at last minute, and that was Ali Mazahiri, the person who I saved his life, the person who came to the bus many, many years before. I knew Ali Mazahiri. I saw him on and off a couple of times, and then the day I decided I can probably try this last chance, I knew the person almost in charge of the passport was the person who owed his life to me, Ali Mazahiri. The idea of Ali did come and go because it was dangerous for me to go near Ali. Ali was in the passport office. If I went there, it was going to the minefield, walking on a minefield. I could get arrested immediately in the passport office. What are you doing in passport office? It's a suicide. I went to his office and completely panicking and scared, trying to act very relaxed and normal. And I said to his secretary my name. I said, can you please ask him, tell him my name, see what happens. He came actually to the door when he heard my name and took me inside and hugged me and was happy to do anything for me. But when I said to him, I need a passport, there was just silence. He just said, okay. And a couple of days later, he gave me a passport in the street. We just saw each other maybe for 2 minutes, got the passport. When I walked away, he said, you have 48 hours to leave. and then never come back, or I get hanged. Crossing the border, I had to go with the bus. There are checkpoints. Each checkpoint, I died, really, and got back to life. I got through the checkpoint. Just walked towards this Turkish police officer who had a nice uniform with tie. And he said in English, "Welcome to Turkey." I was shocked in the most beautiful way possible. After the first 2-3 days, I started searching for a synagogue in Istanbul. I was so excited. It was a simple building, and I saw these Jews coming. I was watching every single individual to see how they look like. Do I look like them? There was rows of wooden benches, and we were sitting all people next to each other. Then they had Torah in their hands and, you know, whisper things or silently pray. I was asking my Adonai to, I was basically talking to him that, you know, that I never wanted to do this, to betray people. When I walked out of synagogue, I felt like I'm forgiven. I felt like I will be given an opportunity. But the shame and guilt that I feel for it is significant. I would say subconsciously all the time is there. I don't think there's forgiveness for me. I think I betrayed my heroes. I hope if anyone hears my voice, forgive me, or, you know, understand what happened.
You can find out so much more about Kushar Karimi's story and his work at our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score for that piece was by Pat Masidi Miller. It was produced by Anna Sussman. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, how to take a bullet and the worst choice ever. When the Snap Judgment Cross to Bear episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Cross to Bear episode. Today, we're going past people's phony facade to learn what burden they're actually carrying. And for this story, we have to go to a little-known place in California where Jesse De La Cruz grew up. He knew, but he had two choices in life. Either be a farmhand like Pops or make his own path. Snap Judgment.
There was a guy in my neighborhood, his name was Biginho, and he was basically the guy that really trained me to become who I was, okay? And you know, everybody talked about him like he was God, bro. Like, you know, everybody was like, wow, you know. And I was like, I was mesmerized by what everybody said. And I knew he was in prison. I knew he was in prison. He had been in prison for a long time, right? And he had a wife, her name was Thelma. And you would never hardly see Thelma. It's like she was doing time with Indio, you know what I mean? So I remember looking at her thinking, man, that's the kind of woman I want, just like that. So I met Big Indio when he came out in probably in 1960. Indio was about, I don't know, maybe 6'1". He reminded me, I'm not lying, man, he reminded me of these Aztec warriors that I had seen in the library, right, in the picture books. You know, broad-chested, wide-shouldered, bronze, big mustache, hair jet black, combed to the back, you know, laid down, right? And he had tattoos, you know, like all over his body. Nice tattoos, right? And he was ironing his pants. And I didn't know it at the time, but what he was doing, he was watching me with his peripheral vision. And I was in awe, right? I was like, oh, And all of a sudden, he turned and he looked at me and he goes, "What's your name, little vato?" And I said, "Who, me?" And he goes, "Yeah, you." And I said, "My name is Chuy," because that's what my mom called me, right? Jesus. I said, "But everybody calls me that I won." I flexed my my chest, right? And he sort of like grinned at the gesture, right? And he like looked at me and he goes, "Hey, look at," he goes, "check this out. I'm gonna tell you something that I don't ever want you to forget this." He said, "Never ever trust the white man and never trust the black man." He said, "Always stick with your raza and remember that we're in a war." And I went, "Damn." When people walk down the street, you know what I mean? Even though they might have not liked being Indio, they acknowledged him, letting him know that they knew he was somebody to be reckoned. That's the way I took it. So I watched it all. I said, "Man, you know," and he had everything. He never worked. But I'll tell you one thing, he always was dressed really nice. He had a nice car. And I think, well, how in the heck he do that, man? Well, I found out later he was a criminal, you know what I mean? So I said, "I want to be a criminal." They had nice women, they had nice cars, they partied, they did all the things without even having to work. Then I heard, but they had to go to jail periodically, right? And I said, well, you know, that's part of the job description, man. You know, go to jail. So I made a decision, and Indio began to school me. Like, in other words, he would tell me, "Listen, don't ever break into people in the barrio's home. Don't steal from them, because they ain't got nothing. Go out and steal from the farmers, the ranchers. They got plenty. You know what I mean? Get it from them," right? He would tell me, "Don't talk, because when you talk, you can't hear what's going on." Now I talk. Back then I didn't. It's a backdrop of some mountains, right? There's mountains. And then this huge facility made of stone, right? And then you see the gun towers, right? And you see the fence, big double-lane, chain-link, you know, barbed wire fence, right? And I was like, wow. And so my heart started pounding. I remember my heart started pounding, and I was like, wow, you know, I'm here, man. Okay. You know, prison, it was like a rush. You know, it was like it made you feel, it made me feel like I was important. You know what I mean? You know, like I was somebody. These were my kind of people. They all had that look. It was a look in the eye that told everybody, you need to be real careful here. You know what I mean? Because this is somebody that will take your wind, right? So, you know what I mean? Everybody had that look. I was in San Quentin. I remember one time I was in San Quentin in the hole, and I seen the look in this guy, right? And I thought to myself, damn, that dude's got the look of death in his eyes, right? And I wondered if I had that look, because I was there too, right where he was at. That's what I thought, right? But I couldn't see it because in the hole, you don't have mirrors. So I had to wait till the following day when I went to take a shower, and they give you a little square stainless steel mirror, right? And I looked and I said, man, I have that look too, man. It sort of depressed me, right? So years later, you know, when I was, I think I was about 30 years old, which would have made Indio about in his 50s. I came out of prison, I think my second time, and I went back to the neighborhood just to visit, and I went to the park where everybody, you know, the fellas hung out, right? And when I got there, Indio was there. But he didn't look like he looked back then. In other words, he was not this Aztec warrior anymore. He was, you know, he was an old man. You know, he was an old man ravaged by the lifestyle, you know, alcohol and drugs, you know what I mean? And Thelma had left him. You know, he's just nobody no more, right? And he was drinking some type of beer. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a quart he had in the bag, you know. And it was a little bit daunting to go against him, right? Because I always used to look up to him, you know what I mean? So I sort of had to conjure, what's the word? I think that's the word. The courage to address him, you know, to confront him with what I thought was his manipulation of me, right? You know what I'm saying? And so when I got to that point, I just blurted it out. I told him, "You lied to me, man." He said, "I didn't lie to you." And I said, "Yeah, you did. The people that were trying to kill me was Mexicans just like me. Blacks weren't trying to kill me. White people weren't trying to kill me. It was Mexicans like me that were trying to kill me. It was you that was trying to kill me." I remember he looked up and he looked at me like, "What?" I don't think he was prepared for me to do what I did. He goes, "No." He goes, "That might be true, but I did not lie to you. I schooled you because I knew, I seen where you were going. I knew when I saw you that you were going to end up in this journey. And the things that I taught you kept you alive." He was right. He was right, bro. But at the time, I didn't know it because I was full of anger. So I stabbed him. I didn't kill him. I just stabbed him. Couple of times. You know, I just wanted to let him know. I wanted him to feel a little pain.
Thank you, Jesse, for sharing your story. Now, Jesse has turned things around. He just graduated with a doctorate in education and now works as a gang expert, helping those falsely accused fight the charges. The original score for that story was done by Snap's own Leon Morimoto. This piece was produced by a dear friend of mine, Danielle Alarcón, who is the creator of the amazing podcast Radio Ambulante. You're going to want to subscribe with a quickness. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. When Snap Judgment, the Cross to Bear episode continues, we head straight into the heart of darkness. For real, stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Cross to Bear episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and we've learned here on the Snap that the very people that look like they're holding it all together, those are the people you gotta watch. People like Dr. Lee Warren, a brain surgeon, who was with his family when he got a call that would change everything. Snap Judgment.
The first time I walked into the hospital, I went through the emergency department, and there's a long, probably 30 or 40 feet wide hallway that served as a staging area for mass casualties. All of the stretchers were empty except one. I see the nurse taking care of this guy. It looked a little bit like he'd been kind of cut up with a weed eater. He had little skin tears all over him from a bomb, basically, that had gone off. And the nurse said, "Oh, it's just a little bomb. Nobody died." And I didn't think about there being big or little bombs at the time.
Lee's an Air Force neurosurgeon. He enlisted back in his 20s to help pay for medical school. He'd done a stint in Germany, but now here he was in 2004 in Iraq, the second neurosurgeon to ever be deployed since Vietnam.
The hospital was in, you know, tents, and they were calling it Mortaritaville because it was getting mortared every day, and there was just a lot of unknown.
Back inside the emergency room, Lee studied the man the nurse was tending to. There were four numbers scrawled across his forehead in black Sharpie marker.
It was 1856. The number written on his forehead, and really didn't know what that number was. And at first I was thinking it might have been some kind of Arabic inscription with his name or something. And because she said, "That's his name." And I said, "Well, what do you mean it's his name?" And she said, "He was a terrorist." she realized then that I was new, and she said, well, it's a numbering system. You know, we write their numbers down because we don't know who they are. So that's how we keep track of which patient is which. You had this notion that you're going to be able to look at a person and tell if they're bad or good, right? But then here I'm just looking at this kid who looked like the kid who delivered pizza to me in San Antonio. It's this little teenage-looking young man. When I went to bed that first night, my head was full of thoughts of whether I had what it took to do this job well. I was worried. I didn't have the sense before I left that I'd be taking care of the enemy.
But Lee didn't have time to think about what it meant to be taking care of the enemy. Every day there were too many patients to take care of at the same time. American soldiers, insurgents, and the Iraqi civilians caught in the middle. The only sense of order came from the trauma czar, a general surgeon who called the shots. He decided which patient had the best chance of surviving and therefore got treated first.
More than once I had to go in between patients and you know, change clothes, change socks, change underwear because I'd be soaked in someone else's blood. I did have a hard time sleeping. There was so much noise. There was always a jet, a helicopter, a mortar, a gun, somebody shooting an automatic weapon. There was just noise all the time. And then after a few days, you had so much sort of fodder for your mind that when you tried to sleep, you just saw all these injuries and all the death. You could hear all the screams and the smells and all that it was difficult. But after, I guess, a week or so, I was so fatigued that I started sort of just collapsing, you know, passing out.
Lee eventually got used to all the noise. But then his fear of getting blown up gave way to something else.
Somebody actually literally shot at me and the other neurosurgeon I was with a rifle. And then we dove behind a barricade, and almost immediately, American guards returned fire down a street that we couldn't see, and they fired back with automatic weapons a few rounds, and then it was over. But it really made me angry. I was like, hey, if you get shot, we're going to take care of you, but here I am, and you're shooting at me. It didn't seem fair. It was a constant source of aggravation that never really went away for me.
That began to change one day. It started with the bad weather. Lee could hear rain pounding down on the canvas tents. This was a good sign. More rain meant less bombs and less catastrophe in the emergency room. But then a colonel summoned the medical staff. He had bad news. All flights were grounded. They wouldn't be getting a resupply of medical equipment for a couple more days. For Lee and the other neurosurgeon, that meant they had to make do with the few remaining brain surgery instruments they had left. There were only four.
I was just hanging out in the hospital with my colleagues when the tech comes running down the hall, you know, literally saying, hey, mass casualty, 10 minutes out. My first thought was, you know, I hope it's really not true. I said a little prayer, and to my shame, I hope that all the injured people were not Americans. There was a series of car bombs that happened close to the base, and there were 20-some-odd Iraqi civilians and a bunch of U.S. Marines that came in one big wave. Within a few minutes, all of the beds in the emergency room are filled up. The trauma czar is walking around the room and keeping an eye on everyone and organizing the chaos. And we wound up with the first four patients having to go and have surgery.
Lee took the fourth patient, a young Marine named Lewis. He had a bandage on his head from either a bullet or shrapnel. It was hard to tell. But as Lee was getting ready to operate with the last set of surgical instruments, another patient was wheeled in. The number 2280 scrawled across his chest.
He had lost tons of blood. He had a bullet in his forehead, significant frontal lobe injury on both sides, and was bleeding out. You can bleed to death from a scalp laceration, so he was in trouble before he ever got there in terms of blood loss.
And between Lewis and patient 2280 stood a corporal.
And I walked up and said, Corporal, you need to get out of here. You need to go to the waiting room and let us do our work. And he says, please save Lewis. He's my friend. He's my best friend. We're going to do everything we can, but you need to get out of here. And then he turned around and he said, this guy, pointing towards 2280, is the one who shot Lewis. And then I shot him. So the corporal fired the shot that put the terrorist down.
The corporal was stoic, almost robotic. But Lee had seen enough of these men come through to know he was shaken. Lee promised him he'd do everything possible to save his friend.
The situation was dire. Both of these guys had life-threatening brain injuries and needed surgery right then. There was only one surgeon. There was only one set of instruments. The czar sort of left it up to me. I was having to make a decision to treat one of them and not the other. There was never a thought in my mind of letting the American go. But for the first time, sort of had this hit on my conscience that, you know, these are people that we're fighting. They're not nameless, sort of faceless, evil beings. They're humans that I'm dealing with, a person that happens to be identified as my enemy because of, you know, where we are and what the situation is. But I just thought I couldn't get past the idea that 2280 had a chance, and if I gave him a chance, then he might survive.
Still unsure about how or if he was going to treat both men with one set of surgical instruments,
I made the decision that we were taking both of those guys to surgery at the same time. So a few minutes later, we're in the operating room. I've got a razor, you know, a non-powered razor shaving the Marine's head, Lewis's head. A general surgeon named Chris is next to me, and he's shaving the terrorist's head. We're prepping both their scalps with iodine and preparing them for surgery. The technician, Nate, opens the instruments and sets everything up.
And at that moment, the other neurosurgeon walked in. He'd finished with his last patient and was ready to help out. But there was still only one set of clean instruments, so they brainstormed a plan and just hoped it would work.
I asked the nurse for the scalpel, and she placed it in my hand. And at the same time, Tim, my partner, the other neurosurgeon, received his scalpel, and we both made our skin incisions on the patients about the same time. We open the scalp. I take the drill to make a hole in the patient's skull and open the skull up until I could remove it, and then handed the drill to a nurse who was standing in between, and she poured alcohol over the drill to clean it, sterilize it as best she could, and then handed it to Tim, who continued to use that same instrument on his patient. That was just the only thing we could do if both of these guys were going to live. As I proceeded through the surgery, like I'd done hundreds of times before, everything was the same as any other operation, except for this growing fear in my heart that we were doing something that we would never have done in the United States. Here we are in a dirty tent hospital in the middle of the war, in wounds that are already contaminated, and now we're using instruments that aren't completely sterile. Every time we passed an instrument between these two guys, the likelihood of one or both of these men getting a meningitis or a serious brain infection was very high. It was very, very terrifying for me. There were four or five times through that operation that Tim needed something that I still had, and when I was finished, I would hand it to him. But as time went along and the cases got a little bit more under control and more instruments went towards the other neurosurgeon's side, then it became clear that we were going to get both these guys through the operation at least. I finished my case first. So after the operation, I walked out into the surgeon's lounge and I noticed the corporal sitting there. He was holding his helmet close to his body and he was more sad and remorseful. And I told him his friend was alive. Lewis is alive and we've given him a chance to survive, but that's all I can say for now. And then he looked at me and kind of nodded and said, "What about the other guy?" At that moment, the speakers came on overhead, and there was an announcement that they needed B or O negative blood because of a critical shortage in the operating room. And about the time I was thinking through in my own mind that wasn't my blood type, the corporal stood up and stepped past me towards the blood bank. And I said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "Well, I'm B negative. I'm going to go donate blood. Somebody needs it." I felt like I had to tell him that the guy they're calling for blood for is the guy you shot. I mean, the guy that hurt your friend. I see him, you know, stiffen up, and his eyes fill with tears, and he sets himself up, and he said, "You know, people have done things for me that I didn't deserve, and I shot that guy, and now I have a chance to do something for him, so I'm going to," and he did. He went on to the blood bank and donated his own blood.
A few days went by, and patient 2280 woke up.
I walked into the unit where he was held. I saw him there, lying on the stretcher. He was sleeping, had the bandage still on his head. The monitors were all out. The 2280 had kind of faded from his chest. And I looked at him and just thought through all the things that had happened to him. And as I picked up his chart, I noticed his blood counts were back to normal. He had lost about 80% of his own blood in the operating room that day. that meant that most of the blood that he had in his body was from that corporal, the corporal who had shot him. I never saw him again.
Lee never saw the corporal or Lewis ever again either. He heard Lewis recovered and was transferred to the Army Hospital in Germany. Patient 2280, he was transferred to the Abu Ghraib prison later that day.
In fact, that's something about war that I think I never really expected to encounter until I was there, is that there's not a good answer or a right answer. There's just what you have to do to get through it.
For more of Dr. Lee Warren's experiences in Iraq, know that he wrote a book, No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. And he also has a podcast. The original score for that piece was by Renzo Gorio and was produced by Nancy Lopez. It's that time, Snappers. One full hour spent in our universe. You're welcome back anytime. Just subscribe to the Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast. Do it right now, because Snap was produced by the team that always has a tremendous cross to bear. Make some noise for the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, Pat Massini Miller, Anna Sussman, Julie DeWitt, Nancy Lopez, Joe Rosenberg, David Kim, our Tupac listening crew, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Matt Ducott, and Jasmine Straight No Chaser Aguilera. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting would like to announce they are changing their name to the Snap Judgment Number One Fan Club. We applaud their decision. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could take selfies all day, post to all your social networks only to get home, look in the mirror and see what is that hanging out of your nose, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.